Welcome to the first ever broadcast of All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Executive Director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Larry Larson, Principal of Larson Associates, a consultant working with arts organizations seeking to use technology in innovative and creative ways. Larson Associates specializes in helping its clients use databases and dynamic websites to realize ambitious programmatic and administrative goals. This describes your work with the John Cage Trust perfectly, Larry. How long have you been with the Cage Trust?
I think this is the 21st year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And you were brought to us by Bill Cook.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Our dear friend, Bill Cook.
Bill Cook was at the time, he was with Cunningham by then. He had come to Cunningham from the Wexner Center and was Merce Cunningham's executive director for a period. And he decided that Larry Larson and Laura Kuhn would love each other. And so he arranged.
The rest is history.
That's right. But
he. Except.
Except for the very beginning, where we kind of looked at each other and went, eh. Anyway, so you've been with us for a long time. Larry was not, I should say, our first web developer. The truth is, I, as the executive director of the Cage Trust, was a little bit resistant to a website because I had always considered, always, but to that date, I had considered websites to be tools for sales, tools for advertising, monetary magnets of some sort. And since the John Cage Trust had always been self-income generating organization, I just didn't see how that would work for us. But of course, that changed when I met you. Larry, you were also the first of the three web developers that we had who made me understand the need for me to provide you with the databases. That was my job, and that you couldn't work with nothing. And so that opened up a whole, really, two decades and still ongoing work, providing material for you to work with. But I'm really curious, I've never asked you this question. You know, we had, as I say, we had two web developers before you, neither of whom felt comfortable really representing Cage and really representing the Cage Trust. They were just squeamish. There was something a little squeamish about doing that. I never experienced that with you. And what do you think that's about? I mean, how do you think you were different?
I don't know.
Really?
If I had any, I certainly had cause to be squeamish. Cage was a hero of mine. He kind of briefly waltzed through my life when I was in music school, and I was had his records, I had the books. I should have been, you know, overwhelmed, but I wasn't. And I think the reason that I wasn't is that it just wasn't a website that we really had to build, because that is narrow. What we really had to build, you know, was this a database.
Right.
We had to take the work of John Cage, which is the most database resistant set of work that I know of, and force it into this construction.
Right.
And it took us years to get the works database working.
I mean, yeah, literally, I think that was 10 years. I think it was eight years, but it was a long time. You know, when John Cage died, one of the first things that happened was that I had to bring together a team of scholars who would make a working catalog of all the music manuscript. And I can't tell you how many fights broke out between and among the people, because there were two Americans, one Dutch, one German, and one Hungarian who cried most of the time.
So usually it's the Hungarian.
Exactly. Yeah. We really had fights because things didn't fit neatly into categories or couldn't.
Right. And I don't want to bore people with talking about databases, because I think of this work as being larger than a technical project. But nonetheless, a database does not admit ambiguity.
Right.
At all. Right. Gesture means nothing to a database. It's just yes, no, ultimately.
Right.
And that was, you know, just a huge mental problem to solve. Yeah. And I enjoyed that.
I think I did once I got over the shock of the fact that I had to do the work.
Well, you know, yeah, this whole thing is predicated, totally predicated on the fact that you knew the answers.
Right. So it's like he's asking me questions again.
Yeah, I mean, because no, otherwise there would have been, you know, there are many websites, as you well know, around the world that talk about John and try to represent his work. Right. But no one was able to do it with the same level of detail we could, because we had access to the text, as mm-hmm. it were. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you represented that. And now, at least, it's there. It's in, I mean, not print, but the equivalent digitally. You know, it's not going to disappear.
No, and this, you know, not a week goes by that we don't get, you know, kudos from people and words of thanks for just having such a useful catalog, if you will, of not just, you know, not just the works, but the libraries. I remember when the John Cage's personal library, which lives at the John Cage Trust, when we finally got that database done, people couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that they could look at and search, fully search everything that was in Cage's library.
That was a fascinating aspect of this thing. The obviously discography, which is related intimately to to the works database. You know, what else do we have? I even forget sometimes.
Well, we're working now on artworks.
And making a real progress on that.
And we have our permanent art collection. For those of you who have tuned in, we have our permanent art collection, which is not, it hasn't been to date represented as a database online for people to look at the works, to understand the different categories. And so that's, it's coming. It's coming.
But that's close. That is, you know, there's been a few things we wanted to do that for whatever reason didn't work out. One is the autobiographical statement.
Right.
Where
we
I
had
think
big
we,
plans.
We had huge plans, and that was our downfall.
Yeah.
Well, every time we came to a decision split, we took the detail side.
Yep,
and then that led to another detail side, and then we were overwhelmed.
It's true. And the other thing that just never caught on was the folksonomy.
Yeah.
Which I still don't understand.
To tell people what the autobiographical statement was.
Yeah, so the autobiographical statement was Cage's own statement about his life. And it ran, I don't remember, I want to say 10 to 12 pages. And it's available on our website. You can even look at it. And we give it out to people to use on their own websites if they want to go to all that space for Cage, as opposed to, you know, just a little paragraph or something. But it's on our website. But we had this idea that we would hyperlink the whole thing. So anytime Cage mentioned a person or a place or a work, but the problem was—
He mentioned
was,
his mother, you click the mother and you'd see her articles in the LA Times and the social columnist.
Exactly. And we had, then it moved into many layers. Remember, we had top tier, second tier, third tier, things that came off of other things.
A little bit of nausea to think about it. It was basically trying to separate water, you know.
Yeah.
It just wasn't going to work.
I know. It's sad because we worked on it for a long time. But you once told me that things that came out of the John Cage Trust, and not pointing entirely all fingers at me, but, you know, things that came out, like Kuhn's blog, that, you know, I was writing a blog. And for a while, my blogs, you said, were like small television shows.
Yeah.
That you were like trying to produce these things, which were very media heavy and very complicated with media.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what that was happening with the autobiographical statements as well.
I think, I mean, in the 15 years since we had the idea and now, many of the technical hurdles we had then, we simply didn't have.
Right. Now. Right.
It would be technically just almost routine.
Oh, don't even say that. You know.
Almost again. The thing that's not routine is your part.
I know. People say, well, there's a pandemic. You know, you can't have visitors right now. Just do it. You could do it.
What do you do with all the time?
Yeah.
And then in terms of other things we've done together, of course, we have to mention the various apps that we've put together.
Right? Mm-hmm.
A couple of which gained a little bit of traction.
Yeah, I remember when. So let's talk about Larson Associates for a second, because okay. your two colleagues weigh in a little bit here.
Definitely.
On each of those apps. So we had Didier Garcia, who I think is no longer with you.
At the moment, he's taking a huge project down in Philadelphia.
Oh, good.
So
good.
He is. So, you know, we still talk. And uh-huh. Jack Freudenheim.
Uh-huh, who's still on Katona, or he was.
Yeah,
he's,
and with whom I talked today, actually. So
good.
Yeah, but they were entwined in building those apps.
Exactly. So there are two apps, for those of you who don't know them. The first one that we did, that was Didier's baby, Larry and Didier, and that was Cage's Prepared Piano app. I never forgot this, Larry. You'll probably remember it when I say it, that I was walking down 8th Avenue one day, or it was like around dinner time, actually, and I was thinking about this, like, wasn't there a way to do something with the prepared piano sounds? Because we had collected all of them with Nurit Tillis, the pianist who used to play with Steve Reich. And she went on to do our 2012 centennial LP set, the analog of
so beautiful
Sonatas and Interludes, exactly, which we're going to play a little bit of that, I think, next week. But anyway, I digress, because I was walking thinking about, wasn't there something that we could do? I don't know what. And I looked up and you were sitting in a restaurant, an open air restaurant on 8th Avenue, not too far up from the Cage Cunningham Loft. And I said,
Thai restaurant.
Yes, it was a Thai restaurant. It was open air. You were inside, but it was open air. And I came in and I said, God, I was just thinking about you. Do you want to do this? I don't know what it would look like exactly, and you said, yes, I think I would. And that was it.
Yeah, I remember that day really well.
You do? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that led not to the app. This is a precursor of the app.
Right.
This was Larry produced really the whole recording sessions of Nurit Tillis. We captured all the sounds of the prepared piano, the preparations, preparing a piano, the same piano that Cage had used in his original work for the Sonatas and Interludes. And then also in iterations. So we had mezzo forte, we had forte, right?
We created a definitive sample CD at the time.
Exactly.
Which was the term of art you had at that point for a sample CD, and it made quite a stir.
Yep.
And we had to mention Michael, of course.
Michael Rouse. You know, so Michael was our audio engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Michael Rouse
played
a
pivotal role in doing this. And so that was done, and it's still available.
That's right. Big Fish Audio in Los Angeles.
Big Fish Audio, a deal that I set up flying to Washington. I felt like, you know, a big time Hollywood producer, you know, setting up that deal, and I've lived on it ever since.
I wish.
Yeah.
God, I wish.
But then we had these.
We had all the sounds.
We had these WAV files. And then I literally do not remember whose idea it was to create.
I think it was yours, Larry. I think it was
really?
Yours. Maybe yours and Didier's together. It might have been Didier had such beautiful design skills.
Oh, yeah.
There was just nobody like him. If anybody looks at the Prepared Piano app, which, by the way, is available from iTunes, it's not expensive.
That's for sure. But Jack played
so
a big
beautiful.
Role in doing the first proof of concept version.
Of course.
He's the guy who said, yeah, this would work.
Uh-huh.
And so he deserves at least as much credit as I do for it. Mm. And now, when I hope to have the time in the relatively near future, given how busy things are pandemic-wise at this point, to completely rewrite the app using current samples. Because that app was not meant to be a musical instrument.
Right, and that's what people wanted it to be away.
People wanted to be able to say, okay, I'm going to sit at my keyboard and play this, and then I want to be able to record it using what have now become standard music plugins.
Right.
We designed this to be basically an educational, not a toy, because it's really cool, but nonetheless, it's not for serious music making. as the sample CD was, for
sure. Yes, the sample CD ended up, a lot of filmmakers were drawn to it, both professional and amateur filmmakers.
And it's still, you know, there's no reason that its usefulness has diminished in the slightest now, even though it was made using almost 20 year ago technology.
Exactly. I mean,
now we would make, there are still no loop samples in it except for the raw piano tone of an unmodified C sharp. You know, we looped that because we weren't going to create a sampling piano. People spend millions to do that. All of the prepared notes were not looped.
Right.
And are allowed to expire. And so there's, aside from the fact that it's, you know, 44.1 hertz when now people would expect 96 or something, it's as good as gold. Anyway, right. My hope is to redo that app sometime.
I would love it. I would love it.
Middle of winter. And also make it such that it can be a plug-in, you know, on mobile iOS devices.
Right,
it's
right,
a
right.
Totally iOS. No, actually, at the moment, sadly, it's both an iOS and an Android app. But after I redo it, it's going to be only an iOS app.
Right, it'll go back to being an iOS.
Right.
And then we did the other app. So we have that. But that app, by the way, I want to just say that Larry and I had a great deal of pleasure watching that app climb the charts. Do you remember Larry?
It was kind of exciting. It taught me certainly that it's a very steep slope between the people who are making money selling apps.
That's right.
And those
that's
that
right.
aren't. Because we were like the number two music app.
I know, for
a
days.
Little while.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that that's a very long tail.
Right. And we made something like $17.80.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad, but it was.
I know, but you know what
nothing
I mean.
That was going to put you in a new tax bracket. You know?
Right.
But that app is still in use. It's got thousands. We should tell people what the app is, right?
Well, it's called the John Cage Prepared Piano.
No, I'm talking about 433 now.
Oh, you're talking about the second app. Yeah, the second app. This app really caught, it captured the imagination of a lot of people. And the pandemic just made it even more popular because you could
travel. That was our
travel.
Marketing strategy. We couldn't wait for something like this.
8 years ahead of schedule.
Those McKinsey consultants make their money, let me tell you.
No, it was in 2012. It was Cage's centennial year. I think whose idea was this? Phil Stone's idea.
Phil Stone at UC Davis.
That's
he
right.
He had the idea. And you and I thought, oh, I don't know about this. You know, it just like seemed kind of gimmicky. And we wondered, how good is the recording capability
of an iPhone
without an outside microphone? And then we played with it and we played with it. And somehow we decided to go with it.
Yes.
And then Phil and I worked together to build.
Right. So what this
app.
Was for listening audience, it was basically an app. It's just called John Cage's 433. And it transforms your iPhone into a recording device with a program that's resident through the app that parses out the time into three movements, the same time span as Cage's original time spans for the three movements for 433. And it captures the ambient sound of wherever you are. And then once you're done, it actually tidies it all up and places it on a world map, which is also available through the app. So you can at any time of day click on 433 recordings that have taken place. We're on all the continents now. We
except
are.
Antarctica.
Yes,
we
except
don't have an
Antarctica. Yes,
I'm waiting for that one to happen.
Right. I remember when we got our first Africa. That was really exciting.
Yeah. There are, I think, 5,000 plus discrete recordings now. I might be low. And you can listen to them most easily on the app, which
of
is course. Obviously still available. But you can also go to the Cage website and go to the app page, and they're all there too. And you can click on one and listen.
It captured people's imagination a lot because it was being like an armchair tourist, you know, that you could literally be at home and listen to ambient sounds all over the world.
It caught on, and you know, we had so much interest in it, you know, in the press.
Yep.
I know that Phil was interviewed. I was on NPR talking about it. It was featured in The Guardian in the
Right,
UK.
exactly.
That's another one that jumped up to the top of the
Right,
precipice
right.
at Apple and then shooshed down to the bottom.
As the next 433 app came along.
Yeah, right, yeah. Oh, God, not another one.
Exactly. There's no, you know, there's no dearth of innovation in this country, you know, or in the world.
But I'm really proud of my part in that.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Proud Phil of Stone, though, deserves credit for coming up with the idea.
Of course, of course. But, you know,
and an important part of the coding. He did the part that was above my head.
I remember we got stuck at a certain point, and
we got stuck multiple times. Yeah, it was really very complicated. And every time a new iOS comes out, I, you know, take the beta and I test. And a couple of times it's failed. And so we've managed to, you know, recompile it and it's worked. You know, but any developer goes through that when iOS. Right.
I always know because I received the incoming email relative to it, and which is
why 90, is this happening?
90% of it is, "Dear John Cage Trust, I did this and it doesn't work." And I sent them to Larry. I said, "This one's for you."
And I want my 99 cents back.
Exactly, exactly. But I could tell you, even if I were, you know, deaf, dumb, and blind, when a new iOS took place, because the incidence of these emails from people increases.
Yeah.
It's like, gee, Larry, new iOS over there, huh?
Yeah, we had a problem with the map rendering in the new one. Which always scares us, because then you go into this source code and you're just thinking, well, I have to, and luckily we was able to figure out, it's been rewritten a lot since it was first done,
because
a lot of the technology is no longer even, it's insecure.
Of course, of course.
Talking to our AWS servers and all that.
Well, speaking of, that sort of technological shifting around, Larry, you've had to deal with the whole, forgive me, I don't know the language, but, Flash was important to us and then it wasn't,
Flash back in 2004. 2005.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, not Flash so much as, I don't want to get too technical and bore people. Yeah, Flash. and we built the Folksonomy on Flash.
Right, which rendered rendered completely unworkable.
Well, now Flash is officially dead.
Right. I
mean, no one could even use this now, but people stopped using it 3 or 4 years ago and it was considered DOA. But we weren't alone in that. It's just that we didn't have these budgets that allowed us to set our team of developers on rewriting all this stuff.
Right, right. No, I know. I know, Larry, I know.
Actually, I know too.
I would very hopefully answer some of these people who I send on to you, but I would write and I would say, I'm going to send this on to our developers or blah, blah, blah. We're really waiting for an angel, in the hopes that somebody would say, what do you need?
No, people write, why isn't there an Android version of this?
Right,
well, it's because Android would be a complete, total, bottom-up rewrite.
Exactly.
And there's no commonality there.
Yeah.
And I know, just to let people know, if they look at the piano, Prepare Piano app, there is one little bug in it that will not be fixed until the new version comes out.
And what's that? What's that?
The ability to upload your little performance to a server, which isn't really public, but allowed you to share it to anyone who might be interested. The whole 95% of what that app about still is perfect. Just that one little piece won't work because of how technology has changed. Apple won't let us rebuild it. It's frustrating. And 90% of the emails you get is, I tried to share my performance and I can't do it. And I can't even put a build in there that says, hey, this doesn't work anymore. Right. I mean, the fix is ridiculously simple, but I can't redo the build. Thank you, Apple. The other thing that's interesting, that's just a little interesting note, in terms of 433, speaking of Apple, when we first submitted this to Apple, because you have to go through an approval process.
Of course.
And they wrote back and said, this is a completely trivial app. We have no idea who John Cage is and why would someone want to do this? And I had to send them back being very, very respectful. You know, the link to John's Wikipedia page and the link to the 433 page on Wikipedia, and to say, I don't think it's as trivial as you might think.
Yeah.
And then I pointed out to them that John Cage, back in their Think Differently ads, the Think Billboard,
sure,
Don was one of those Think Differently
ads. That's right. That's
and that
right.
was my final little note. You might not be aware of that. And so they quickly approved it.
Jeez. But, you know, I want to say there's something very sweet about this, and it ties very much into the John Cage Trust as a whole. You know, that it's really because of the, oh God, I don't even know what to call it, the generosity of Cage himself and the way that he worked and the kinds of work that he did and why he made his work the way he made his work that allows us to play. You know, that allows us to make apps like that, that it's absolutely in keeping with, you know, Cage's legacy. It's absolutely in keeping. That would not be the case for any and all composer, you know,
no, I mean,
at all.
What Elgar app could you put
right,
up there?
Right,
you
know? Right. That's exactly right, you know.
Hum along to the cello concerto, you know.
That's right. Where Cage's work is just so open, you know. And, you know, I've said this in a previous show, actually, but it bears repeating here. It's like, you know, the John Cage Trust has always been less interested in what Cage did, but what Cage is doing now. And, you know, that extends to things like these apps. You know,
That's what I like to think. And that's why I humor myself by thinking that my remit is, you know, just larger than being a web guy.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah. So that leads me actually to the question that I really wanted to ask you is, you know, what is your work? You know, I don't mean that fleetingly. I just mean, what is the work of a developer? What's the big picture? I mean, does it have to do with furthering
Well, I can tell you, no. I
mean, not right,
for
right.
99.9999% of developers. I have been lucky beyond comprehension to have to do this kind of work, creative work with artists that I worship, you know, and I've had clients, you know, Merce Cunningham, of course, the Carnegie Hall. I mean, it's just a long list of things. Where most developers are working on stuff a lot less interesting. And many of the developers that I have worked with in the past wanted to work with me, even though they weren't making as much money, because the art was interesting. I mean, actually, everyone who's ever worked with me is a musician, and it was just a thrill for them to be involved with this, as opposed to, you know, working for Bank Paribas, writing, you know, SQL, T-SQL queries. It was a joy. And that's what kept me interested. How has the developer changed? It's changed so that it's completely unrecognizable from what it was when we started together.
Really?
Years ago.
Uh-huh. I mean, well, that's utterly interesting.
Utterly, the tools and techniques and the concepts, the paradigms. If medicine would have changed as much in 20 years, it's every day you have to learn something new. The minute you're not learning something new, you're basically history.
Because you can't continue in the field because the field doesn't stop.
Yeah. And for someone like me who's been around for a long time, you know, that's kind of a big deal, because either you constantly learning new technologies or you're basically working on what's called legacy work, which is work for old code, old paradigms that, like right now, one of the hottest programmers around, believe it or not, are COBOL programmers. COBOL is the business programming language from the 60s and early 70s that basically does a lot of heavy lifting. And all the guys who have all retired, but a lot of those programs are still important at banks. You go to ATM transactions. And if you know COBOL, they're paying money out. They're desperate to have you because
how
they're all retired. Yeah. You know, and it's because huge investments were made in that at the time. And everyone thought that it would be around forever. It's not. You know, we were talking earlier about how John passed away just at the beginnings of the web, really.
Yeah, it was fledgling, to be sure. And there was email. We had email. I remember Cage receiving emails when he was working on Your Operas. So the Your Operas 1 and 2, that was 84 to 87. And then it premiered shortly thereafter. So there was production stuff going on between Frankfurt in Germany and New York. And I remember some email exchanges. I don't remember him writing emails. I remember him receiving emails, working with Andy Culver, who was his programmer really at the time, but also production assistant. I remember Andy working a great deal via email. But I was, as I was reminding you earlier, you know, Cage did make, he made the acquaintance of the people who had developed the well out in the East Bay in California, right? Weren't they
They were in Tiburon.
Oh, they were in Tiburon. Oh my God. One of my favorite places in the world is Tiburon. So beautiful.
And by virtue of work I was doing back then in the early 90s, I actually met the guy who founded it and then sold it to whoever they sold the well to.
Right.
But yeah, that was the height of internet idealism.
Right. You
know, we thought this was going to save the world. This would be the greatest advance for humanity. You know, maybe not.
Well, Cage was working on this project, which was a very young and very amorphous kind of project. It was a piece called The First Meeting of the Sati Society. And it was a collaborative work that he had put together, inviting friends, Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg. Oh my gosh, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but they all contributed either visual artwork or texts. And these were all gifts that were going to be put together and presented to Satie as gifts from people who loved his music, or as Cage put it, would love their his music if they knew it. But it was going to live on the internet. This was going to be a web-based art project.
That was a visionary thing.
Yeah, and it didn't.
I wish there was some sort of product it had left that we could use.
Well, no, there is a product, but it turned into
glass
valise a la Duchamp. And eight handmade books. You know, each of which is a gift. And there are little Thoreau quotations that have been hand stamped in the metal casing. And it's an astonishing work.
Put that on the web somehow?
Right. It turned into this really monolithically difficult object because it's a sculpture. Two of the books are music scores. Yeah. It's poetry. It's visual work. You know, literally it's sculpture. You can hang the box on the wall and it's cracked glass, but stable. You can change the position of the books inside so the sculpture changes. You know, it's kind of every art form in a weird way.
Who owns that work now? Where is that work?
Well, it was a limited edition. So the Cage Trust, we have one at the Cage Trust. You could come
I've
and
never
see
seen it.
Oh, you can come
I've
see
never,
it.
You've never shown it to me.
It's, you know, until we moved into our big, beautiful house at Bard College. Thank you, Leon Botstein. Until we had a big, beautiful house to inhabit, our archives were scattered a lot. And the visual artwork was never with us. So you probably never saw it because it physically wasn't there. But now everything's together. Everything is in one place. Yeah. So next time you come up, you can see it. It's incredibly beautiful. I mean, it's a really, really beautiful piece. But as I say, it began its life on the well. It began its life conceptually as a piece that was going to be made for the internet and live on the internet. But that was a hard sell for Cage, a hard sell for his colleagues.
To the other artists.
Exactly. Yeah, we want you to make this, but it's not actually going to be a book. It's, you know, it's going to be pixels on a screen, you know.
And anyone can copy it.
That's right. And it's probably, you know, and probably being copied now as I speak. And that was very John, you know. Anyway, I forgot where we were going with this.
We're just talking about where John would have done if he had, you know, lived 5 years longer.
Yeah.
What the internet actually became.
Yeah.
And his reaction to it would have been. The fact that it was, in a way, kind of founded on anarchy, you know, without top-down control,
right,
you know, might have interested him. I don't know.
Right. I want to read something to you. I pulled it up in before doing this conversation with you. I was kind of hoping to find, you know, something appropriately prophetic by Cage, because he was generally prophetic about things. So it was a long shot, but you know, but
yeah,
I did.
God, there it is. Yeah.
But I found, I'm going to read it to you. I was hoping I could find it in audio form, but it doesn't exist in audio form. These are three different things that came out that come from three different interview sources in 1965. Okay. So we're talking 27 years before he died and long before the internet was a thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to just read this to you. The notion of the physical distribution of 10,000 books is another problem, not so much electronic as it is mechanical. The machine of the book belongs to the Renaissance. The things of intangible distribution belong to electronic technology. When Bengt Emil Johnson speaks of the poetry that will not so much be consigned to books as to recording, the moment they become recordings, they will be able to be distributed with great ease, with no difficulty whatsoever, throughout the world. But once they've been experienced, the tendency of technology will be not to keep them, but to ask you for another one, something new. This is the spirit, I think, of the new culture, not to keep, but to constantly give.
Could have written that today.
The second paragraph says, so this question of distribution, this is a different interviewer, different person. So this question of distribution is related to museums and to monuments and so on. Of course, we will have that problem, but it will be a disease rather than something simple. And the last paragraph is the most prophetic. He says, we can't be satisfied with distribution now because it won't be very good. For instance, my book Silence, published in the United States, is very difficult to get outside the United States. And that won't be solved because of all the publishing problems of books and objects and things in quantity are still those of the previous culture. Yet with the number of people who work now, the number of composers, the number of authors and so on, has vastly increased over the 19th century, but the number of publishers has not increased. The result is that you have traffic problems. So you have the kind of problems that all large cities encounter with automobile traffic. And I hear where I go now that in the future, we may expect that private traffic in large cities will be forbidden. It may then equally be forbidden to produce a book that would require people to distribute it. But it will not be forbidden, certainly, to send information by electronic media throughout the world. The end. 1965.
Well, that, picturing myself as a child in 1965, I wouldn't have said that.
Well, you were a little younger. So, you were a little younger.
Was proof of his genius. You know, the irony there, of course, is that the way the world has developed now, that last statement isn't true anymore, where things, major nations, you know, China, Russia, have gone off this electronic distribution system, and you can't get the book. You can't get a lot of books in China on the internet. And,
but that's for a different reason, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just, you know, it's just striking. That was a, you know, just an extraordinary thing to say in 1965.
Yeah.
As we were listening to the Beatles singing Help, you know.
On and our analog. Going through puberty. Don't forget puberty.
Yeah, that was just pretty much it. Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I think that, I think I actually sent this to Jeff Bezos, that last paragraph, a long time ago, you know, like.
God, that's the perfect person to send it to.
I sent it like a decade ago. And never heard anything back. No response.
That's a big surprise.
Yeah.
You should publish that in some sort, make it, bring it out into the open again,
yeah,
as you're doing here.
I'll bring it back. Yeah.
Because it's you know, it's a stunning kind of, you know, visionary thing.
Yeah. Well, I was only half kidding when I said, oh, I need something prophetic by Cage on this subject. Let me dig around in the books, you know, because the truth is that he was prophetic about a lot of things. He also used to say, you know, another thing.
Electronic music.
Yeah, all of it. You know, he was very fond of saying two people doing the same thing is one too many.
Yeah.
You know, and that was why he backed away from electronic music, because David Tudor was doing electronic music. And David Tudor did it better, according to him, you know, that it came more naturally to David Tudor.
Yeah.
And he didn't like repetition.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, with the Your Operas, which is the collage opera that he did. I remember when we got back from Germany where it had been premiered. And I said, is anyone going to record it? And he said, oh, wouldn't that be terrible to just, you know? And I said, no, what if we could record it so that it changes every time you play it, you know, that it rearranges the elements. And he said, oh, wouldn't that be marvelous, you know? So he was saying that was eminently possible with CD-ROM technology, which had another decade to go before that was really available. So he was making things with new technology before the new technology was there to actually receive it, if you will. I know.
Yeah, you're decades, stunning. Decades. Yeah. It makes my thoughts seem so trivial.
No. But it gives us a lot to work with. You know, I mean, I think he also used to, I mean, another quote that comes to mind is, you know, with your comments about China and Russia, he used to say that things are going to have to get a lot worse before they get better. Mm-hmm. And
we nailed that one.
He used to say that a lot, you know, that things are just going to have to get worse before people take things, you know, in hand, that they actually understand the consequences of not doing anything. If you look at things like, you know, climate control and stuff like that, I don't know how much worse this is going to have to get before somebody pays attention, until somebody actually behaves like it does matter.
I can't even express an opinion on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I'm so overwhelmed with anger.
Yeah. You know? It's been a really fun month, hasn't it?
It certainly has. Tell people this is December 1, right?
Yeah. Are you experiencing, like I'm experiencing, this time distortion?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just living in time distortion right now. I feel like I've been the same age for 5 years. I really don't get it.
I just go back and thinking, well, okay, March was a reference day. It was my birthday in March when the big lockdown started. So I have
congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Larry.
And it looks like around my birthday next year will be when things really begin, ideally,
to get better,
open up again.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about, this is off the topic, but, you know, people working on those vaccines, and can you think of something more important to do right now?
Yeah. You and I had that conversation. That's actually something I'd love to hear where you are with now. We had a conversation in which, so forgive me for divulging something of your life, but Larry's wife is a nurse, and
she works in neurology.
Right.
She's not really a nurse. She analyzes EEGs.
Okay, so she is a technician EEG of technology. Sorts.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But anyway, the whole point of this is that I was talking with Larry, this is months ago now, and he was watching Janice go to work, and her work being absolutely critical and putting herself in danger every day and to really serve humanity as we knew it. And Larry was experiencing some difficulty with his own life, feeling, what is the point? And it reminded me.
This was
me,
in April in New York City.
So exactly, April in New York City. And oh no, it made perfect sense. But I said, oh my God, you remind me so much of John Cage. And you said, how is that? And I said, well, you know, remember when the war broke out And it was really in the years just after the war, the World War II we're talking about, the late 40s, where he went through a crisis of faith about what was the point of being a composer? What good was it? You know, what good was it to create music? And he really had to, really, he struggled with his own self-worth. And I don't know, it just struck me that you were kind of going through the same thing through this.
Yeah. Without a doubt, I felt totally useless. Mm-hmm. Because there was no traffic and you wouldn't take the subways. Janice works, we live in Brooklyn, and her hospital is up in Harlem, in the west side of Harlem. And so rather than have her take the dangerous subway, dangerous because of the virus, of I drove her up and down twice a day. Right. And I did that obviously gladly, because it was my own infinitesimal contribution to, but every time she'd get off, she was walking into this, you know, hellhole.
Right.
And I felt like I would just have done anything to trade places with her, mm-hmm. you know? And just because I felt useless, then of course there was no work and nothing was happening. We couldn't go outside. My teenager kid was home, of course. And I just go home and sit on the couch and doom scroll until it was time to pick her up.
Right. Oh my God, you're the second person to use that expression with me in a day. I'd never heard it before until today.
I wonder why. Oh no, I'm a big doom scroller.
My God.
I can stop whenever I want. I don't have a problem.
Well, you know what Cage did. You know, Cage developed a way of working, which he believed was a transformative thing for him as a composer, developing chance operations, developing a way of working, which was about discovery, so that he was changed by what he was doing. He believed that that was also the case for players, and he believed that that would be the case for audiences in hearing this work. And so it gave him a purpose. It gave him a feeling.
I believe that to be the case.
Yeah.
I truly do.
Yeah. And he talked, you know, he talked about that many, many years later as something that was a very, very dark time for him. And that this new way of working got him out of this terribly dark space. Well, so it makes us think about.
Apropos.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you still feel that way? Are you still struggling to the same degree?
No, because things are, at least for us sitting here in New York City right now, are so much better than they were on my block, which is, you know, a decent block. There's a very nice funeral home at the end of the block. It's a national landmark. And they had a refrigerator truck in front for 2.5 months with cadavers inside. And Jeez. So we'd walk past that refrigerator truck and it was like, can you believe this is happening? But, you know, I earnestly, obviously, along with 130 million other people, do not want to return to that.
But things are looking better or more promising.
I mean, the virus. I mean, here we're talking about stuff right now. The virus, of course, the vaccine is the godsend.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no way out of this. And
because it's not going away. Virus is not going away.
No. In New York, where things are looking a little bit worse now, but compared to North Dakota, Wisconsin, Wyoming, Arizona, and now California, they're going through what we went through.
Right, exactly. It's not that it's so so much worse. It's just where we were. It's where we were. Larry, yeah. I'm so sad to say that we have to wrap this up.
At least we ended on a high note.
Exactly. You know? I'm so glad I brought that subject up, you know.
That's always my goal, is to leave people feeling better than they came in.
Oh, it's terrible. I'm going to be adding some music to this. Is there anything you'd like me to play for you? You won't hear it. I'm going to add it after we...
Perfect. You know, there's one thing. You were so kind to invite me to be a performer in when we did the, and I'm blocking the name, the second piece we did.
The City Wears a Slouch Hat.
City Wears a Slouch Hat.
Yeah, you were fantastic.
And a piece that, part of that just struck me like a baseball bat was that ending.
Yeah, Foster Reed like, was our reader. Reed was fantastic.
But beyond, but the music that John wrote was like John Cage's La Mer.
You got it. I'm going to play that.
I had never heard that, and I was just like, wow.
It's exquisite. Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry. I hope you'll let me.
Thank you for having me.
It's call on you again. And we can...
privilege and pleasure. If I don't pick up, just leave a message.
We'll duke it out. Thank you so much. Let's listen to an excerpt from The City Wears a Slough Chat, John Cage's first ever radio play, subtitled Incidental Music for a Radio Play by Kenneth Patchen, which was composed on a commission from the Columbia Broadcasting System. This was an experimental program for the Columbia Workshop, and it was given its one and only broadcast over the CBS network on May 31st, 1942, from 2 to 3 on a Sunday afternoon. Cage's original score, all 250 pages of it, reflected his vision of the technological future of music. It was a score written exclusively for sound effects, using sound effects not as effects, but as sounds or musical instruments. Pairing Cage with Patchen was a brilliant move, as Patchen's script accommodated perfectly Cage's vision with its liberal use of sonic imagery. As James Pritchett noted in his marvelous 1995 blog, every scene in the play has some reference to the oral imagery surrounding the characters. Music, street noises, telephones, ocean waves. Indeed, the main character of the play is the voice, and his magical freedom of movement throughout the play suggests the permeation of space by sound. The sweep of the action around the city, up to the sky and out to the sea, could best be put across to an audience through the manipulation of sound. Cage would learn 1 week before the broadcast that what he'd envisioned wasn't actually possible. He then scrambled to rescore the piece for percussion ensemble. 6 players, which could be reduced to 4, and readers, 4, covering a great many parts, including male and female passers-by, a bum, a woman customer and a greengrocer, a thug, 3 gangsters, 2 kidnappers, an usher, a hermit on a rock in the ocean, 2 barflies, etc. Instruments included tin cans, muted gongs, woodblocks, alarm bells, cowbells, maracas, clavis, ratchet, pod rattles, foghorn, thunder sheet, and sound effects recordings. The script sketches a surreal tale of a man, the voice, who wanders about the big city, encountering various characters in sometimes extremely mystifying circumstances. The play would be broadcast with this percussion music, performed by an ensemble led by Cage that included Celia Amidon, Xenia Cage, Ruth Hartman, Stuart Lloyd, and Claire Oppenheim. And it would be this percussion music that all subsequent performances and recordings of The City Wears a Slough Chat would utilize, since the real score, Cage's 250-page score for sound effects, seems to have simply disappeared. Recordings of this work are available from the Cortical Foundation, which put out a re-release of the historic 1942 recording, as well as from Mode Records and Nexus Records. The last, Nexus CD number 10937, is the recording from which the excerpt you will hear was drawn. Nexus Percussion, by the way, performed the work in a staged version that included a film comprised of light and shadows by the New York composer Michael Rouse. This was seen at John Cage On and Off the Air, a 2012 centennial program produced at Bard College by the John Cage Trust. We'll be listening to a few minutes from the close of this piece, which takes place at sea, the part that Larry Larson referred to as Cage's La Mer. One letter writer, responding to the original 1942 broadcast, called this the ocean surge and described it as the apotheosis of interpretive music. The Nexus percussion performers are Bob Becker, Bill Kahn, Russell Hartenberger, and Gary Kvistad, with Ray Dillard conducting. The voice, uniquely cast here as a woman, is performed by Adanya Dunn. Thank you.
I am coming into your house with my hand outstretched. I am your friend. Do not be afraid of me.
Thank you.